Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present career U.S. diplomat Robert Oakley, who explains why he and 26 former U.S. diplomats and military commanders signed a statement condemning Bush administration policies that led to war in Iraq and growing isolation of America across the globe. Maritza Castillo, the mother of Camilo Mejia, recently convicted of desertion, who discusses why her son refused to return to Iraq and efforts to appeal his case. And Bob McElvain, whose son Bobby died at the World Trade Center on 9/11, assesses the work of the commission investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks at the conclusion of the panel's public hearings. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Christian Science Monitor reports that a new Cold War-style arms race is brewing between the United States and Russia. Over the last 2 years, the Bush administration had broken ground on a missile defense complex in Alaska and pushed ahead on a new generation of nuclear weapons. In response, Russian President Vladimir Putin has promised Russians that the U.S. missile shield can be broken. Russia is also working to develop a new missile, the SS-27, that is designed as a maneuverable warhead that could move unpredictably at high speeds. In another sign of frosty U.S.-Russian relations, this spring, Russia launched its biggest military exercises since the Soviet era. In addition, Russian Defense Minister Sergei Ivanov objected strongly to 4 Belgian F-16 fighter jets that were sent to Lithuania to patrol the expanded NATO border with Russia. Russia has extended the lives of its existing stockpile of SS-18 and SS-19 intercontinental ballistic missiles and has also purchased 30 new SS-19s from the Ukraine. Still, Russia's military readiness is in doubt, as 3 Russian ICBMs failed a recent test. In the U.S., there is a great deal of skepticism about missile defense, which was compounded when the General Accounting Office, a nonpartisan arm of Congress, concluded that only 2 of 10 key missile defense technologies have been proven to work. A new report, titled Turning a Blind Eye by Human Rights Watch, concludes that Coca-Cola and other multinational companies are indirectly profiting from child labor in El Salvador's sugarcane fields. According to the website oneworld.net, Coke does not own any of the plantations studied, but buys sugar from El Salvador's biggest mill, Central Izalio. Sugar production is only second to coffee, El Salvador's leading export crop. The sugar plantations were privatized in 1995. Human rights monitors say that many child laborers get hurt cutting the sugar cane because they still use machetes, work in the direct sunlight, and boredom leads to frequent accidents. Moreover, girls usually plant sugar cane. While this is less dangerous than harvesting, it is very tiring because the child planters need to keep up with tractors that make rows for the sugarcane. At harvest time, child workers are usually required to work around the clock, which means skipping several months of school every year. In response to the report, a spokeswoman for Coke replied that none of the local soft drink bottlers in El Salvador or their suppliers use child labor. After weeks of box office buzz, McDonald's has launched a counterattack against Morgan Spurlock's film Super Size Me, which shows the consequences of eating only McDonald's fast food for 30 days. In the documentary, we witness Spurlock's health decline as he eats McDonald's food. His blood pressure skyrockets, his liver falters, and his doctor tells him to kick the Mickey D's only diet. Now, Australia's division of McDonald's is running a slick TV campaign to counter Super Size Me. The ads feature Gary Russo, head of McDonald's in Australia, attacking Spurlock's film as wrong, unjust, and over the top. Super Size Me slams the new healthy McDonald's menu by showing that the nutritional content of salad dressings like Caesar salad has more fat than a cheeseburger. According to the London Independent newspaper, just 6 weeks after Spurlock's documentary premiered at the Sundance Film Festival, McDonald's decided to phase out its supersized menu items from its American outlets. The oversized portions were never available in Australia. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
In In April, 52 former senior British diplomats signed a letter protesting Prime Minister Tony Blair and President George Bush's handling of both the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the occupation of Iraq. Now, a group of 27 former U.S. diplomats and military commanders have endorsed a similar statement condemning White House policies in the Persian Gulf and the Middle East. The group, calling itself Diplomats and Military Commanders for Change, asserts that U.S. security has been weakened by current administration policies by prosecuting an ill-planned and costly war in Iraq justified by the manipulation of uncertain intelligence. The signers also express concern about growing hostility toward the U.S. in the Arab and Muslim world due to Washington's unquestioning support for Israel and close identification with autocratic regimes across the Middle East. Those signing the statement, including Arthur Hartman, former ambassador to the Soviet Union, Admiral Stansfield Turner, former director of the CIA, and General William Crow, one-time chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have served every Republican and Democratic president since Harry S. Truman. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with 34-year career diplomat Robert B. Oakley, who served as ambassador to Pakistan, Somalia, and Zaire. Oakley, a special envoy for Somalia under Presidents George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton, explains why he and other senior diplomats and former military officials have publicly condemned Bush administration policies and declared that it's time for a change.
Generally, the statement says that the way in which the Bush administration has been conducting its foreign and national security policy has, in effect, weakened the United States because, as we found the hard way, going it alone is not sufficient, and military force is not sufficient, even when backed by our economic might and by our sense of righteousness. We can start something, but it's very, very difficult to finish it in a way that's satisfactory to U.S. interests. And over time, a number of us began talking here and there, and we said, look, we really ought to make a statement instead of talking, making a speech here and a speech there, or testifying before Congress here or another hearing over there. Let's see if we can't put our heads and minds together. And so about 3 months ago, we began to put this statement together, and ultimately it came to fruition, and we issued it. It wasn't political, at least it wasn't meant to be. People have accused us of being partisan. We'd like to say we're being professional, because we feel that the United States has been weakened, quite frankly, because of the approach which has been taken.
Well, just to deal with the charges of partisanship, those who are unhappy with your statement, the 27 signatories accuse, I think, the majority of those signers as being Democrats, partisan political Democrats. You've served Democrat and Republican presidents through
all of
decades.
All have been appointed by Republican administrations to positions of high responsibility as ambassadors or, in some cases, four-star generals, ambassadors, representatives to the United Nations. It's not political at all, and the views are not Democratic. Most of us have been considered, I would say, probably Republican, but in fact, it never entered our minds while we were in professional service as to whether we were Democrats or Republicans. We were there as professionals, and we still look upon ourselves as professionals. A number of us have been solicited by the Kerry campaign. By and large, we've tried to have people on this signing this letter who were not Kerry advisors or activists. Maybe in a couple of cases it slipped through the net, but our approach has been to find people who are not directly associated with the Kerry campaign. We didn't consult the Kerry campaign people before, and we haven't talked to them since.
Robert Oakley, in the statement signed by yourself and 26 other diplomats and military commanders, diplomats and military commanders for change, you assert that our security has been weakened by Bush administration policies. Be specific. Tell us how you think the Bush administration has endangered this country.
Well, by first undercutting our alliances and weakening them to the point where some of our allies stood up against us and said, no, we oppose what you're doing in Iraq. Countries like France and Germany, we've come back to a degree of cooperation with France and Germany, but belatedly and after a lot of damage was done, by putting a huge strain upon our military forces because we had to play catch-up ball because we didn't devote enough military forces in the beginning and the right type of military forces in the beginning because we thought, some people said, it would be a cakewalk. We've exposed our military forces to a great deal of danger, but in addition to that, we strained the system, the personnel system, the maintenance system, the supply system, and the military commanders who are with us are afraid that this can have some effects similar to those which Vietnam had upon the U.S. Army, where it was severely degraded and unable to take on tough tasks after Vietnam until it had been sort of retooled. And so we're a little bit worried about that, too. Now, fortunately, in countries like Iran and North Korea, which originally were on the axis of evil list, and the implication was they're going to be subject to preemptive military action to change the regime, but we've decided to shift to a more multilateral approach in trying to deal with those problems, which is good. But again, this constitutes a change from the original approach, but we're glad to see it.
Maybe you can address the perception of the United States around the world, according to some public opinion polls, as you state in your the document you signed. Fear and hatred of our country is a big concern and assists in recruiting for terrorist organizations. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think that's right. What appears to be almost total U.S. support for the Israeli regime and whatever it plans to do, despite some bold statements by the United States, we've never really put our muscle behind the roadmap, which is supposed to be a balanced bilateral approach to dealing with problems with the support of the EU, the United Nations, and the Russians. Instead, it's Prime Minister Sharon sort of moving things in his direction with what is seen as the support of the United States, both political support and military support. It's U.S. helicopter gunships that are seen to be assassinating Palestinian leaders. And images of this on Arab TV, accompanied with images of U.S. Helicopter gunships making attacks in Iraq, you see these things have gotten, erroneously perhaps, but nevertheless very, very strong in the Arab consciousness, so they've become fused with one another. And this has caused a lot of people in the Muslim world, particularly in the Middle East, to say, okay, we're willing to join terrorist movements for the future, as well as coming into Iraq now. And the amount of opposition in Iraq has increased because of this rather than decreased. So we have a lot of work to do to rebuild our position in the Middle East as a whole, where our most trusted allies, like President Mubarak, have said they'd never seen the United States so hated.
That was 34-year career U.S. diplomat Robert B. Oakley, one of 27 signers of a statement condemning Bush administration policies in Iraq and elsewhere. Read the statement by diplomats and military commanders for change online by visiting the group's website at www.diplomatsforchange.com or call their office at area code 202-408-4998. On May 21st, Iraq War veteran Staff Sergeant Camilo Mejia Castillo was convicted of desertion and sentenced to 1 year in a military prison. Mejia, who was a citizen of Costa Rica, spent his teenage years in the U.S., where his mother became a naturalized citizen, but he did not. He joined the National Guard at 19 to earn money for college. He was 2 months short of completing his 8-year army hitch when he was sent to Iraq. After serving 6 months there, he returned to the U.S. on a 2-week furlough and was then ordered to return to Iraq. Even though he had fulfilled his contractual obligation, the Pentagon's stop-loss order directed him and thousands of other soldiers to serve beyond their standard tours of duty. Mejia, a member of the Florida National Guard, refused to return to his unit in Iraq, citing moral reasons, the illegality of the war, and the conduct of U.S. troops towards Iraqi civilians and prisoners. He requested discharge as a conscientious objector. The Army chose to prosecute and sentence him, despite a pending decision on his application for conscientious objector status. Mejia contends that a treaty between the U.S. and Costa Rica, which has no army, establishes that a Costa Rican citizen cannot be forced to extend his military service in the U.S. His 1-year sentence for desertion was the maximum he could have received, since he was not charged with desertion under fire. He is the first soldier known to be tried for desertion after service in combat in the current Iraq conflict. One of his lawyers, Ramsey Clark, spoke of the incredible irony that we're prosecuting soldiers in Iraq for violations of international law, and we're prosecuting a soldier here because he refused to do the same things. Mejia is appealing his conviction. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Maritza Castillo, Mejia's mother. She talks about what led to her son's decision to refuse his military orders and about her efforts to free him, supported by groups such as Military Families Speak Out and Amnesty International. Camilo's father, Nicaragua's best-known revolutionary singer-songwriter, Carlos Mejia Godoy, is also doing everything he can to help his son.
There were many factors. The lack of respect for a person who no longer wants to be in a war, and who is asking legitimately and lawfully to leave the war, and they won't let him. Also, Camilo observed in the war abuses of prisoners and excessive force used by the army in Iraq, many civilians, including children, dying. I want to explain that it is not like Camilo came home and just decided from one day to the next that he wasn't going back. There were various factors.
Once he turned himself in, then what happened?
He was detained in a military base for 2 months, and on May 19th, he had a trial, during which he was convicted of a desertion, and he got a year in prison. He's in Oklahoma in Fort Sill.
And do you know why they sent him to Fort Sill so far from his family in Miami?
Para castigarlo todavía más.
To punish him more. Camilo is a man who is now an example before the world and to other soldiers. He decided not to return to the war because the war was immoral, illegal, cruel, and abusive. He was within his rights not to return, but the army had to punish him severely to give an example to other soldiers who don't want to continue in the war. Also, because they can't punish him more under the law, they sent him far away from his family, from me, from his daughter, and from his lawyers.
What's his frame of mind now that he's in prison?
When Camilo was on trial and he was found guilty of desertion, he had an opportunity to address the court, and he said to them, "It's not just me on trial. It's you too. It's America that's on trial for this war. I don't repent of what I have done. I'm sure I've done the right thing, and I am glad I did it. You have the power to send me to prison, to punish me severely, and it hurts me because I have a little daughter. But I am satisfied with my decision. And even though I'm behind bars, I'm a free man because I listen to the voice of my conscience."
Are they mistreating him in prison?
No, but he has many restrictions. For example, he cannot receive mail from many of the people who write to him. They're keeping his letters, and maybe they'll give them to me. They are always observing him. There is always a soldier nearby when he talks on the phone, and he cannot talk more than about 15 minutes because the calls are collect and are very expensive, like $50, $60, $80 each time he calls.
Can you talk about your efforts to free Camilo? What are you asking people to do?
I'm working very, very hard to pressure the government of Costa Rica to lodge an official protest asking for Camilo's immediate release. Also, Amnesty International is supporting me. They declared Camilo a prisoner of conscience. We're also pressuring the U.S. Army to release a transcript of the trial as soon as possible, because without a transcript, we can't file an appeal. Then we formed a committee called Free Camilo Committee to demand that the Army make the transcript available as soon as possible, and also to say to General William Webster that he reconsider the sentence of my son, because in reality, he is a legitimate conscientious objector.
Realmente es un objetor de conciencia reconocido y legítimo.
That was Maritza Castillo, mother of Sergeant Camilo Mejia. For more information on efforts to free her son, visit the website www.freecamilo.org. As the commission investigating the September 11th terrorist attacks concluded their public hearings, the panel issued three reports outlining how al-Qaeda planned for the attacks and how U.S. government agencies responded. The commission contradicted the Bush administration's assertion that al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's government had collaborated on attacks against the United States, a key White House justification for launching the Iraq War. The report also concluded that U.S. defense and civil aviation agencies were unprepared to defend against the September 11th hijacking of four passenger airliners, and that since the 2001 strikes against New York City and Washington, al-Qaeda has transformed itself from a centralized organization into a loose network of regional terror cells. As the commission prepares to issue a final report in late July that will include recommendations for how to strengthen national defenses against future attacks, the State Department was forced to retract an April report that boasted a decline in terrorist incidents in 2003. The number of terrorist acts and the number of victims had actually sharply increased. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bob McElvain, whose son Bobby died at the World Trade Center on 9/11. McElvain, a member of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, assesses the work of the commission and expresses concern that critical issues have not been seriously addressed by the panel.
Every meeting I come out of, I'm always upset. I'm frustrated, and usually I get depressed because I don't feel I'm getting enough answers to so many questions that are out there. You know, I never intended to get this far into it. You know, after my son died, I really spent a long time trying to investigate exactly how he died because he wasn't really supposed to be in the North Tower. But and then I just started reading information about things that happened, you know, a year before, 2 years before that day. So I was really questioning the story that we got. It just seemed like too simple of an explanation. And so the joint Senate congressional hearings, I was down there when they ended that and they gave out the 800, 900 page book. And when it showed that the 28 pages of Saudi Arabia were deleted from the book, I really started questioning everything. So I've spent my entire life just reading, trying to get involved in this and seeing what the real truth is. And I understand what's happening to the commission because they're trying so hard to be nonpartisan. I feel there should be accountability and blame. Someone messed up that day, and this is my problem. There hasn't been a reprimand yet, and that's just mind-boggling, all this information's out there. And so my only task in life is I want to give information to people. I want people to make up their own minds, so at least get the information, but no one's getting the information, and that's the problem.
What are the essential pieces of information that you don't think the panel investigating 9/11 has brought out or has investigated thoroughly enough?
Well, the Saudi connection. People in America still don't know that 15 out of 19 were from Saudi Arabia. We didn't get into the... I mean, there's just so many things. The visas. Why were visas so easily given out? And that 15 Sauds, I mean, Springman, the counselor in Saudi Arabia, was so upset by this that they didn't need any checks to get into the United States. So, I mean, that's just one thing. I don't remember hearing anything about that. Again, Bush's connection with the Saudi Arabians for so many years. They've been involved with them so many years, and the fact that we're not talking anything about Saudi Arabia. And then the other thing is all the information Bush said before. Condoleezza Rice said in 2002. Mueller said before September 11th, we had no warnings about attacks in the United States. Well, not once have we gone through any of the warnings except for the August 6th memo. Yet in the August 6th memo, there was information from the British indicating that there's going to be a major attack by hijacked planes in the United States forthcoming. So nothing of that has been mentioned, and that's very upsetting to me. So in other words, their position is we're not here to place blame, we're here to make policy. So in essence, they ask questions, but they won't get too tough. And another thing, they only have 5 minutes to ask questions, so you really can't get into real difficult questions. So there are just a few of the things that, you know, haven't been answered.
If you could devise a different process for finding blame and rooting out those folks who overlooked the warnings or ignored them, what do you envision? And from the knowledge you have now, who do you think should lose their job over what happened on September 11th?
I don't know. I mean, I think the elephant in the room, seems like it always is the elephant in the room, is no one wants to talk about Bush. And if I talk about Bush, then I'm being partisan, and it's a political issue. I don't know. What's Condoleezza Rice's job and George Bush's job? I don't know what they do in life, you know, but I know she's national security advisor, and I know Bush's job is to protect the country, yet he's sitting down in Florida the whole month of August. I mean, at least a horrible reprimand. I mean, the worst we could prove is gross negligence because he's sitting in Florida the whole time. He was on vacation 42 days, what, from February to August.
Bob McElveen, what do you make of the readiness of the United States government to respond to the September 11th attacks then and now? I mean, has the process of investigating the attacks on 9/11 led to reforms and changes and improvements so that this country is better equipped, better prepared to meet those kinds of attacks, which many officials in this government say are inevitable?
Well, I don't think we're any better off we were in 2001. Condoleezza Rice said it very succinctly. She said, we're safer, but we're not safe. Right? And I think we're going about it in the wrong way. I mean, it's proven that terrorism is on the increase in Iraq. So to me, it just seems like this is what they want. They're talking about a 100-year war, and it's absurd. You know, it's just violence. We had violence all around the world. I mean, it's the best thing that ever happened to bin Laden going into Iraq. And it's been proven that the recruitment's been phenomenal. You know, I hate to say it, but, you know, it's the ends justifies the means. You know, if something happens, then, you know, we continue the war. You know, they say it's on their screen, but I don't think the country's safer. Obviously, Condoleezza Rice said that, and they've talked that we're, you know, hopefully the recommendations this commission makes that they're going to do this, but as it stands right now, I don't think we're any safer than we were in 2001.
President Bush has said that his administration, with their military operations in Afghanistan and Iraq, have al-Qaeda operatives on the run. They say they've killed a certain number and arrested another certain number. Do you think the administration is right when they say they've weakened or somehow disabled al-Qaeda as a threat?
Al-Qaeda is, you know, there's cells all around the world now. If they wanted to stop bin Laden, they would have captured him easily. I just don't buy this. I mean, they made a half-hearted attempt to capture him. They made a half-hearted attempt to capture Omar, and they captured neither one of them. And I think, obviously, they left the country in shambles. They weren't the least bit concerned about defeating terrorism at that time because their only thing they were thinking about was Iraq. I mean, Rumsfeld the second day was talking about Iraq.
That was Bob McElveen, a member of the group September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, whose members will commemorate civilian war dead by marching from Boston, the site of the Democratic National Convention, to New York City, where the GOP will hold its presidential convention. Get more information about the group by visiting their website at www.peacefultomorrows.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.